Chapter 8, Why We Have Leaders. The hunters returned victorious. After a long day of tracking, a journey that took them miles from home, they were able to kill a deer big enough to feed everyone. Upon their return, many of their tribe rushed in to congratulate them and take the carcass to be prepared for the feast that would soon come. But there was a problem. Everyone was hungry and anxious to eat. When living in populations of about 100 to 150 people, as our ancestors did, clearly, the whole tribe couldn't just rush in and grab food. Chaos would ensue. So who gets to eat first? Fortunately, the social chemicals inside our bodies direct our behavior to help solve this problem too. Companies and organizations are our modern tribes. Like any tribe, they have traditions and symbols and language. The culture of a company is like the culture of any tribe. Some have strong cultures and some have weak cultures. We feel like we belong to some more than others, that we more easily click with the people in one culture over another. And, like all tribes, some have strong leaders and some have weak leaders. But they all have leaders. Almost everything about us is purpose-built to help increase our opportunities for survival and success, and our need for leaders is no exception. An anthropological look at the history of leadership, why we have leaders in the first place, reveals some objective standards as to what makes a good leader and what makes a bad one. And, like some of the other systems in our bodies that influence our behavior, our need for hierarchies is linked to food and protection. As much as we all like the idea of being equal, the fact is we are not and never will be. And for good reason. Without some rules of order, when the hunters brought back the fresh kill to the tribe, everyone would rush in to eat. There would be a lot of pushing and shoving. Invariably, the ones who are lucky enough to be built like linebackers would get to eat first, whereas the artist of the family would consistently get shoved aside or hurt. This is not a very good system if Mother Nature is trying to keep the species alive. The ones who are shoved aside would likely be less willing to trust or work closely with someone who had punched them earlier that afternoon. So to solve the problem, we evolved into hierarchical animals. When we perceived someone as dominant to us, instead of fighting them for food, we voluntarily stepped back and allowed them to eat first. And thanks to serotonin, those to whom we showed deference would feel their status rise in the group, letting them know that they were the alphas. That's how hierarchy works. Among other advantages, like getting first choice of mate, the alphas were also offered first choice of meat. After they were done eating, the rest of the tribe would get to eat. And though the others would not get the best cuts of meat, they would get to eat eventually, and they wouldn't have to get an elbow in the face when they did. This is a system much more conducive to cooperation. To this day, we are perfectly comfortable with the alphas in our society, assessed in terms relative to our modern community, not just physical strength, getting certain advantages. We have no problem with someone who outranks us at work making more money than us, getting a bigger office, or a better parking space. We have no issue with celebrities getting a table in the hard-to-get-into restaurant. We have no problem with the rich and famous getting the best-looking guy or girl on their arm. In fact, we're so comfortable with the alphas getting preferential treatment, on some occasions, some of us may even get upset or offended if they didn't. Many of us would find it strange or even disrespectful if the President of the United States had to carry his own luggage. Regardless of party, we would be uncomfortable with the notion simply because he is the leader of our political hierarchy. He's the president, after all. He shouldn't have to do that. Some of us would even volunteer to carry the luggage. It's an honor in society to do things to help our leaders. And perhaps at a later date, if they remember or recognize us, they may even throw us a bone while someone else is watching. And if they did, we would feel a burst of serotonin and feel our status and confidence rise as a result. It is because of the advantages an alpha gets in a society that we are always trying to improve our own place in the pecking order. We primp and puff ourselves up when we go to bars with the hope that others will see us as healthy and attractive, worthy of keeping our genes in the gene pool. We like to talk about our accomplishments, hang our diplomas on our walls, and put our trophies on a shelf for all to see what we've achieved. Our goal is to be seen as smart and strong and worthy of the advantages of an alpha, worthy of the respect of others, all to raise our status in our community. This is the whole idea behind status symbols, which, because of serotonin, actually do boost our sense of status. There is a reason that the logos are on the outside of most expensive items. We want people to see the red stripe down the side of our Prada sunglasses, the double C's in our Chanel bags, or the shiny Mercedes emblem stuck on the front of our cars. In our capitalist society, conspicuous displays of wealth may indicate to others that we are doing well. A symbol of our strength and capacity, they earn us respect and boost our position in the hierarchy. It's no wonder some of us try to fake our status. Unfortunately, it doesn't work. Though a good fake may trick others into thinking we are more successful than we are, this is biology, and we can't fool ourselves. A 2010 study by three psychology scientists, Francesca Gino of Chapel Hill, Michael Norton of Harvard Business School, and Dan Ariely of Duke, showed that people who wear phony couture clothing actually don't feel the same burst of pride or status as those who wear the real thing. Faking it, it turns out, makes us feel phony, as if we're cheating. Status is biological. We have to earn it to feel it. The same study also concluded that those who attempted to cheat their biology were actually more inclined to cheat in other aspects of their lives as well. Even though we can indeed raise our status with material goods, the feeling doesn't last. There's no social relationship associated with that burst of serotonin. Again, the selfless chemicals are trying to help us strengthen our communities and social bonds. To find a lasting sense of pride, there must be a mentor, parent, boss, coach, leader relationship to back it up. Leadership status is not just reserved for people. We also offer it to the tribes themselves. Just as we work to raise our individual status within our tribes, companies are constantly trying to raise their status in their respective industries. They tell us how many J.D. Powers awards they have won. They report their ranking in the Fortune 1000 list. Smaller companies are quick to share if they're an Inc. 5000 company, a ranking of the fastest-growing small businesses. The reason we love rankings is because we're hierarchical animals, and there are perks to being higher in the pecking order. However, all the advantages of leadership do not come for free. In fact, they come at quite a steep price. And it is this part of the equation that is too often forgotten in many of our organizations today. It is true that the alpha may really be stronger than the rest of us. We know that all our respect and adoration really does boost their self-confidence. That's good. Because when the group faces a threat from the outside, we expect the leader, who really is stronger, better fed, and oozing with confidence from all that serotonin in their body, to be the first one to rush toward the danger to protect the rest of us. The cost of leadership, explains Lieutenant General George Flynn of the United States Marine Corps, is self-interest. That's also the reason we give our alphas first choice of mate. If they die early while trying to defend us, we want to make sure all those strong genes stay in our gene pool. The group isn't stupid. We wouldn't give them all those perks for nothing. That wouldn't be fair. This is the reason we are so offended by the exorbitant and disproportionate compensations of some of the leaders of investment banks. It has nothing to do with the numbers. It has to do with the social contract, deeply ingrained in what it means to be human. If our leaders are to enjoy the trappings of their position in the hierarchy, then we expect them to offer us protection. The problem is, for many of the overpaid leaders, we know that they took the money and perks and didn't offer protection to their people. In some cases, they even sacrificed their people to protect or boost their own interests. This is what so viscerally offends us. We only accuse them of greed and excess when we feel they have violated the very definition of what it means to be a leader. Few would be offended if it were decided to give Nelson Mandela a $150 million bonus. If it were announced that Mother Teresa was awarded $250 million at the end of the fiscal year, few, if anyone, would make a stink about it. We know that they upheld their side of the social contract. They were willing to make sacrifices for the good of those who chose to follow them. They considered the well-being of others before themselves and sometimes suffered as a result. And in those cases, we are perfectly happy with our leaders receiving all the perks we feel they have earned. The same goes for companies. They earn their reputations by being willing to do the right thing for their people and their customers or clients. That reputation suffers when they break the social contract of leadership. If we consider how we treat celebrities or the wealthy in our materialistic, reality TV-saturated society, All this science seems to make sense. Some people who inherit money, coerce the system, or gain celebrity thanks to the modern media system are afforded certain perks simply because they would appear to have a higher status than ours. But fame is supposed to be a byproduct of alpha status, not a way to achieve it. The same is true for financial wealth. It's supposed to be the byproduct of accomplishment, not the standard for leadership status alone. Unless someone is willing to make personal sacrifices for the good of others to earn their place in the hierarchy, they aren't really alpha material. Simply acting the part is not enough. Just like the phony couture wearer, they may feel insecure about their position or work extra hard to compensate or try to prove to the public and themselves that they are deserving of all the advantages they get. This is one of the reasons a publicist may recommend to a celebrity client that they get involved in charitable work. In our modern world, that's the game. It is important to uphold the appearance of maintaining that deeply seated social contract, that our alphas are supposed to serve us. And though there are definite benefits to a celebrity using their bully pulpits to bring attention to a cause or plight, if they really cared, they wouldn't need to publicize every time they did something. Perhaps one of the sacrifices they could make is the spotlight. The same is true for politicians during election cycles. It's fun to watch the politicians who announce that if elected, they will do all these good things because they care about us. And if they lose their election, many go on to do none of those things. The rank of office is not what makes someone a leader. Leadership is the choice to serve others with or without any formal rank. There are people with authority who are not leaders, and there are people at the bottom rungs of an organization who most certainly are leaders. It's okay for leaders to enjoy all the perks afforded to them. However, they must be willing to give up those perks when it matters. Leaders are the ones willing to look out for those to the left of them and those to the right of them. They are often willing to sacrifice their own comfort for ours, even when they disagree with us. Trust is not simply a matter of shared opinions. Trust is a biological reaction to the belief that someone has our well-being at heart. Leaders are the ones who are willing to give up something of their own for us. Their time, their energy, their money, maybe even the food off their plate. When it matters, leaders choose to eat last. By the objective standards of leadership, those who aim to raise their own status simply so they can enjoy the perks themselves without fulfilling their responsibility as leaders are, plain and simple, weak leaders. Though they may achieve alpha status and rise in the ranks, though they may possess talents and strengths that could earmark them for alpha status, they only become leaders when they accept the responsibility to protect those in their care. If they choose to sacrifice those in their tribe for personal gain, however, they will often struggle to hold onto their position once they've got it. Again, the group is not stupid. The people always have the power. The leaders of organizations who rise through the ranks not because they want it, but because the tribe keeps offering them higher status out of gratitude for their willingness to sacrifice, are the true leaders worthy of our trust and loyalty. All leaders, even the good ones, can sometimes lose their way and become selfish and power-hungry, however. Intoxicated by the chemicals, they can sometimes forget that their responsibility as a leader is to their people. Sometimes, these leaders are able to regain their footing. But if they don't, we have little choice but to look past them, lament what they have become, wait for them to move on, and look to someone else to lead us. What makes a good leader is that they eschew the spotlight in favor of spending time and energy to do what they need to do to support and protect their people. And when we feel the circle of safety around us, we offer our blood and sweat and tears and do everything we can to see our leader's vision come to life. The only thing our leaders ever need to do is remember whom they serve, and it will be an honor and a pleasure to serve them back. The Ceramic Cup. I heard a story about a former Undersecretary of Defense who gave a speech at a large conference. He took his place on the stage and began talking, sharing his prepared remarks with the audience. He paused to take a sip of coffee from the styrofoam cup he brought on stage with him. He took another sip, looked down at the cup, and smiled. "You know," he said, interrupting his own speech, "I spoke here last year. I presented at this same conference on this same stage. But last year, I was still an undersecretary, he said. I flew here in business class, and when I landed, there was someone waiting for me at the airport to take me to my hotel. Upon arriving at my hotel, he continued, there was someone else waiting for me. They had already checked me into the hotel, so they handed me my key and escorted me up to my room. The next morning, when I came down, again, there was someone waiting for me in the lobby to drive me to this same venue that we're in today. I was taken through a back entrance, shown to the green room, and handed a cup of coffee in a beautiful ceramic cup. But this year, as I stand here to speak to you, I am no longer the undersecretary, he continued. I flew here coach class, and when I arrived at the airport yesterday, there was no one there to meet me. I took a taxi to the hotel, and when I got there, I checked myself in and went by myself to my room. This morning, I came down to the lobby, caught another taxi to come here. I came in the front door and found my way backstage. Once there, I asked one of the techs if there was some coffee. He pointed to a coffee machine on a table against the wall, and so I walked over and poured myself a cup of coffee into this here styrofoam cup, he said as he raised the cup to show the audience. It occurs to me, he continued, the ceramic cup they gave me last year, it was never meant for me at all. It was meant for the position I held. I deserve a styrofoam cup. This is the most important lesson I can impart to all of you, he offered. All the perks, all the benefits and advantages you may get for the rank or position you hold, they aren't meant for you. They're meant for the role you fill. And when you leave your role, which eventually you will, they will give the ceramic cup to the person who replaces you, because you only ever deserved a styrofoam cup. Eating last is repaid with loyalty and hard work. When the stock market crashed in 2008, like so many other companies, Barry Waymiller got hit pretty hard. The old-fashioned American manufacturing company that Chapman was transforming saw an almost immediate 30% drop in machine orders. The company makes large industrial machinery, the kinds of machines a large packaged goods company would buy to make the cardboard boxes for their products. The machines that Barry Waymiller makes are among the first things to get cut when a company slashes its capital expenditures budget in hard times and opts instead to make do with their aging machines. Chapman and his team were faced with a blunt truth. They were no longer able to afford to keep all their employees. They simply didn't have the work or the revenue to justify keeping everyone on board. And so, for the first time in a long time, the subject of layoffs was raised. For many companies, the option would seem obvious, even if unsavory. But Chapman refused to sack people simply because the company was having a hard year. More and more, he came to see his company as a family, as a group of people to serve and keep safe, and not just as a labor force to be used to serve the company. We would never dream of getting rid of one of our children in hard times, he says. If anything, the whole family would come together, maybe suffer together, but ultimately work through the hard times together. And so, instead of layoffs, the company implemented a mandatory furlough program. Every employee, from CEO to secretary, would have to take 4 weeks of unpaid time off. They could take the weeks off whenever they wanted, and the weeks did not have to be taken consecutively. But it was how Chapman announced the program that proved his leadership bona fides. It is better that we all suffer a little, he told his people, so that none of us has to suffer a lot. The protection Chapman offered his people had a massive impact. Unlike in a company that announces layoffs, sending everyone into self-preservation mode, at Barry Waymiller, the people spontaneously and completely on their own set out to do more for each other. Those who could afford more time off traded with those who could afford it less. Though they were under no obligation to do so, they took off more unpaid time than required just to help someone else out. The overwhelming feeling across the company was one of gratitude for the security they had been given. I suspect in other companies that faced hard times, most of the people would also rather lose a month's pay than lose their job. As soon as things started to pick up again, the furlough program was done away with, and the 401k contributions that the company had stopped paying in the tough times were not only restored, but were backpaid to when the tough times began. The result was astounding. The leaders fulfilled their anthropological obligation of an alpha to protect the tribe, and in return, the people repaid that protection with an intense loyalty, wanting to do whatever they can to help the company. Few from Barry Waymiller ever leave just for more money. To human beings, the safety a strong tribe provides its members makes the tribe stronger and better equipped to deal with the dangers and uncertainty of the outside world. The reason good leaders do well in hard times is obvious. Their people willingly commit their blood, sweat, and tears to see the tribe, the company, advance and grow strong. They do so not because they have to, but because they want to. And as a result, the stronger tribe, the stronger company, is able to guarantee a greater sense of safety and protection to even more people for even longer. Fear, in contrast, can hurt the very innovation and progress so many leaders of companies claim they're trying to advance with every reorg. EDSO Revisited. Each of the feel-good chemicals is essential for our survival as individuals and as populations. They play a role based on our needs and the environments in which we work. Our ability to work hard and muscle through hard labor is thanks to endorphins. Our ability to set goals, focus, and get things done comes from the incentivizing power of dopamine. It feels good to make progress, and so we do. Serotonin is responsible for the pride we feel when those we care for achieve great things, or when we make proud the people who take care of us. Serotonin helps to ensure we look out for those who follow us and do right by those who lead us. And the mysterious power of oxytocin helps us form bonds of love and trust. It helps us form relationships so strong we can make decisions with complete confidence that those who care about us will stand by our side. We know that if we need help or support, the people who care about us will be there for us no matter what. Oxytocin keeps us healthy. It opens our minds. It biologically makes us better problem solvers. Without oxytocin, we would only ever make short-term progress. Leaps of greatness require the combined problem-solving ability of people who trust each other. Like all things human, it is not a perfect system. The chemicals do not fire in equal quantities and in strict allotments. They are sometimes released together, and they are released in varying amounts. What's more, we can short-circuit the system to release the chemicals for the wrong reasons. The selfish chemicals, endorphins and dopamine, give us short-term rewards to which we can, under the right conditions, become addicted. The selfless chemicals, serotonin and oxytocin, take time to build up in our systems before we can enjoy their full benefits. Though we may enjoy the thrill of reaching a goal or winning a race, that feeling won't last. To get more of that feeling, we need to win another race and reach a more distant goal. The bonds of love and trust and friendship take time to feel. We cannot motivate others, per se. Our motivation is determined by the chemical incentives inside every one of us. Any motivation we have is a function of our desire to repeat behaviors that make us feel good or avoid stress or pain. The only thing we can do is create environments in which the right chemicals are released for the right reasons. And if we get the environment right, if we create organizational cultures that work to the natural inclinations of the human animal, the result will be an entire group of self-motivated people. The goal for any leader of any organization is to find the balance. When dopamine is the primary driver, we may achieve a lot, but we will feel lonely and unfulfilled no matter how rich or powerful we get. We live lives of quick hits in search of the next rush. Dopamine simply does not help us create things that are built to last. When we live in a hippie commune, the oxytocin gushing, but without any specific measurable goals or ambition, we can deny ourselves those intense feelings of accomplishment. No matter how loved we may still feel like failures. The goal, again, is balance. When the system is in balance, however, we seem to gain an almost supernatural ability. Courage, inspiration, foresight, creativity, and empathy, to name a few. And when those things all come to bear, the results and the feelings that go with them are simply remarkable.